Okay,
we'll see what's firmly in going, okay?
There's two of them, and they stayed in the exact same spot the whole time. They're not sorry, like I say that.
Oh, my God, I hope that's a plane. Oh, Jesus, please be a plane. Oh, please.
All right, Lisa,
are you ready for this?
The cameraman said, what the hell is that midway across the Hudson River? It was a perfectly circular disc.
For the first time in our history, we're studying something that's studying us.
Nobody told me that these days like these.
Suddenly, something else flew into the frame. Fired a beam of light that struck the dummy warhead, doing a circle, if you can imagine, circling our warhead. Fired another beam of light at it, which struck the warhead.
The Virtually Strange Network presents Strange Days Indeed, your premier source for UFO information, with your host, Errol Bruce Knapp.
Welcome to edition 445 of Strange Days Indeed. This time, our editorial contributor Dave Ferlot, the second part of a two-part interview with Roswell researcher David Rudiak on the new evidence on the famous crash presented by Thomas Carey and Donald Schmidt in their new book, Witness to Roswell, Unmasking the 60-Year Cover-Up. And taking us home this time, Alfred Lemberg with his commentary. This program is somewhat tardy in hitting your ears. There's just so much more to producing it than there was simply by walking into the studio at the radio station with some guest phone numbers and doing the thing live, and that was that. Each of these podcasts takes an average of about 6 or 7 days of production so that you get to hear them the way you have been. Choice quality stuff, jammed with nothing but what needs to be heard by you. So it's quite likely that there won't be as many SDIs per month as you have grown accustomed to. I trust you understand and won't feel taken advantage of. Well, once again, television shafts UFO researchers. This time, CNN's Larry King. Not only jamming in way too many guests into the allotted time slot, but bringing in the new debunker mouthpiece who took over Phil Klass's job, Michael Shermer. Shermer managed to disrupt the little time that Friedman, Jesse Marcel Jr., James Fox, and others had. Former astronaut Buzz Aldrin also cut into the airtime, once again contradicting himself about what he saw on his way to the moon. YouTube has the Larry King Show archive, and you can get to it via the link in this program's listing, if you really want to put yourself through. And Linda Moulton Howe has a most intriguing crop formation report at her site, replete with British researchers on the spot as it was happening, black helicopters making the researchers feel unwell, and some quite dazzling pictures. Linda's site is linked via this program listing, if you hadn't noticed.
These are Strange Days Indeed on UFO News Radio. Here with his take on it, Dave Ferlot.
There's a very long post on the UFO updates list entitled Witness to Roswell Book Review and Details by David Rudiak that is all about the new book called Witness to Roswell, written by Tom Carey and Donald Schmidt. Without the benefit of having read the book yet, the post by David Rudiak almost makes it possible for us not to have to read the book because of how much detail he tells us of what is inside the covers. With that being said, from what I can determine from the post, if somebody were to present a work like that to a science fiction book publisher, they would get a rejection notice because it sounds so incredibly unbelievable. It appears that Carey and Schmidt have done some homework and have spoken to witnesses that have finally come forward after all these long years to tell things that they have been hiding either from fear or from being instructed to keep hidden. To briefly summarize, there was not one, not two, but three crash sites. One which was a debris field, one with the actual spacecraft, and some bodies, and another with bodies of dead alien creatures. There are also witness reports of a live alien creature. The amazing thing about this book is that there are deathbed confessions, reports that were created and notarized to be published after the death of an individual, and even include an incident where one of the people involved with Roswell committed suicide, although it would appear that her suicide was highly questionable, and she may very well have been murdered. What is also interesting is that a few of the witnesses discuss handling some of the debris and actually bringing back some of it themselves. We will have to read the book, though, to find out what happened to that debris after they brought it back. Eyewitness accounts, second and third-hand testimony from relatives and friends of eyewitnesses, and stories that apparently corroborate each other completely independent of the parties giving their testimony. We have independent testimony about the craft that was recovered, saying that it was in the range of 15 or so feet and appeared to be egg-shaped, or when viewed from under a tarpaulin, looked like a Volkswagen Beetle. I can hear some of you right now. Some are screaming that this book is it. This is finally the thing we've been waiting for all this time and tells the whole truth about Roswell, and the Air Force and the government in general will be forced to come forward and tell us the truth. Others are screaming that this has got to be the largest load of BS to come out since the alien autopsy flimflam. Oh, and incidentally, one of the witnesses in the book is a photographer who gives testimony that he was flown in from Washington and was told to take pictures of the aliens inside a tent. It wasn't an autopsy because everybody was cleared out so he could get the pictures he needed with nobody interfering with him, and I strongly suspect that he wasn't given any souvenir shots that he has in an album under his bed someplace. I will be purchasing this book because I will want to read it personally to see how I feel about it. But one thing I already know is that it actually poses more questions than it answers. Firstly, with all of these people picking up stuff at three debris fields, surely one of them must have slipped something into his pocket and held onto it for all these years. So where is that alien ashtray? Secondly, I can understand somebody being silent all these years because they were either afraid of the potential humiliation or of the government taking action against them. But would they not also equally be concerned about their families and extended families? Finally, the question that just seems to get stronger is what incentive do people have to give deathbed confessions or create notarized testimony to be opened after they're dead if the U.S. Air Force has told us the truth and the incident near Roswell was really nothing more than just a crashed Mogul balloon? The problem with this book is not what it reveals to all of us about Roswell. The problem is the U.S. government and the U.S. Air Force has won. Although the witness testimony is compelling, and deathbed confessions cannot be regarded as anything but truth, there still is nothing that can force the U.S. Air Force or U.S. government to allow an independent group to investigate without hindrance everything associated with Roswell or UFOs and be granted unlimited access to files and facilities. Until we are given that access, there is no way that we can either prove or disprove what is on the pages of Witness to Roswell. But that's just my take on it.
Dave Furlong, every week at this time. Strange Days, indeed.
Interesting take, Dave. It's going to be an experience talking to David Rudiak shortly on this version of Strange Days, indeed, and find out what else is in the book, because I'm sure he hasn't posted everything.
No, I'm sure he hasn't. as he puts it at the end of his post, this gives us something to chew on for a bit. It does, indeed. He's not saying one way or the other what he thinks about the witness testimonies. He's just putting them out there and saying, this is what's in this book. This is very interesting stuff, and we really need to talk about it.
What also gives pause for thought is the fact that I think there have only been two responses to David Rudiak's post as we're recording this.
The interesting part about that as well is the fact that it's such a big bombshell that people aren't reacting. It's not you read that post and sort of go, wow, it's like, whoa, I really have to take some time and think about this and try and figure out what's what, because this is amazing. If you had just the witness testimony from, say, the photographer, and we have the guy's name and his rank, that was flown out from Washington saying, I was flown out, I was taken to a tent, I was told to go in and take some photographs of this, cleared everybody out so I could get my pictures done, do my job, that would be one thing. But we have so much witness, new witness testimony, and that it's just like, you can't just absorb it and just make a knee-jerk reaction, so to speak.
Fun times ahead, I think.
I think it's going to be very interesting. I'll also be very, very interested to see some of the reactions from people like Stanton and Kevin. Definitely going to be interesting to see their reaction to the book. Obviously, they will buy it and they will read it.
Yeah.
I can see some interesting stuff coming out from them in the next little while.
Well, we shall, you and I, hold our breath and see what transpires.
Some of the new witnesses that are coming out are going to have to be vetted. It's as simple as that. Like, we're going to have to check and see what's what. This photographer, for example, is the one right off the bat. You got to find out about him and make sure that the T's are crossed and the I's are dotted. I'm sure that David is not going to do a short thing.
I have the feeling it's going to be a long interview.
Yeah.
And I'm going to toddle off and do that. And we'll talk to you next week.
For sure.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
Time you heard part one of the interview that I did with David Rudiak, who told us about the new book by Thomas Carey and Donald Schmidt, Witness to Roswell. Promised you part two in this program, so let's go back a couple of moments into part one and pick it up. David Rudiak joins us on Strange Days Indeed.
Loretta Proctor said your young son, Dee, liked to hang out with Mac Brazel at his ranch, and he was actually with Brazel when he originally found the debris, and then he was with Brazel when he found something else, and apparently Dee Proctor was so traumatized that he never told his parents or any family member what it was he found, but in 1994, he took his mother, Loretta, out to the site. Schmidt and Carey think he had seen the bodies and that this was the body site. Yeah. And then they found this eyewitness by the name of Sidney Wright, who was another rancher son back then. He said there were two other children with him, although either they're not around or they haven't gotten them to talk. He was another one of these very reluctant witnesses. He didn't want to talk about it. They finally got him to talk, and he said there were small bodies with big heads and eyes. And Mac Brazel was there, too. And they were so horrified that they couldn't get away from there fast enough. Don Schmidt at one point said they had some other witnesses to other body sites. They have other smelly alien stories, but apparently they didn't make it into this book. Either they couldn't nail it down or they're holding things back. I'm not sure what it is. Their scenario, I believe, is that maybe some bodies got blown out of the craft, you know, when it exploded over the ranch. And maybe like an escape pod came down further away, and that was the other craft body site. Mm. And there were some aliens still inside that craft. This is common in air accidents where the bodies will be scattered around. Some will come down with the fuselage, and some may get thrown out of the craft and come down miles away. So So that's the sort of scenario that they're proposing here. And that initially Brazel wasn't aware. He was aware of the debris, but he wasn't aware of the bodies, and then maybe he saw buzzards circling around and went to check it out, thinking maybe it's one of his livestock, and came across the bodies. And that's what really prompted him to go to Roswell. It wasn't so much the debris, but the bodies, you know, that freaked him out. So that's the scenario they're putting forth at the moment, I think.
And they also suggest, too, that Jesse Marcel must have seen the bodies.
Yeah, Jesse Marcel was the head intelligence officer, and when Brazel reported finding the debris and maybe the bodies when he came to Roswell, first Brazel went to the sheriff to report it, and then the sheriff presumably talked to Frank Joyce at that time. And then the sheriff and Frank Joyce suggested he report it to the base, and the sheriff called up the base and reached Marcel. Again, he was the head intelligence officer. And Marcel went out to the sheriff's office, spoke to Brazel briefly, said, this is real interesting, went back to the base and conferred with base commander Blanchard, and they decided to investigate, and Blanchard said, take Sheridan Cavett with you, because according to you, Brazel says there's a huge amount of debris out there. Sheridan Cavett was the head of the counterintelligence corps. So they sent the two top intelligence people at Roswell to investigate what was out there. So they must have thought it was important based on the descriptions. There's even a suggestion that Brazel brought debris with them. It was left at the sheriff's office, and then they later came and confiscated the debris.
Mm.
That's according to members of the sheriff's family. Plus, threatened the sheriff with death and the whole family with death unless he cooperated. So Marcel goes back to the ranch with Brazel. And so Schmidt and Carey says, well, if Brazel had indeed found bodies near the debris field, he, of course, is going to tell Marcel, and Marcel is going to investigate. And yet Marcel never said he saw any bodies. Marcel did say, particularly in one interview, the very last interview he gave, he says, there are some things I'll never reveal for the sake of my country. There's some things, if I were to talk about, they'd take me away to the rubber room. So people would think he was crazy.
Yeah.
So the suggestion is maybe he did see the bodies. But Schmidt and Carey actually have two witnesses here who say that Marcel did briefly mention the bodies. She said that just before he died in 1986, they were in a conversation, and the subject, for some reason, of the bodies came up, and he says, yeah, I saw the bodies. Remember, he described them as small, chalky figures. And the other fellow was a tech sergeant named Herschel Grice, who was a ground maintenance crew chief at Roswell, but apparently he also worked with Marcel's intelligence team. Grice said that sometime back then, Marcel said he'd seen the bodies and described them as white, rubbery figures, which was all he could remember. And he described Marcel as a straight arrow, and I've heard that same description of Marcel, too. He was sort of a straight shooter and an honest person. And
like his son.
Yeah. I haven't met Marcel Jr. He's coming out with the book. I've got it on order. I'm hoping there are some big revelations in it, but
yes.
If there are, he's playing his cards very close to the chest. I guess he probably has a non-disclosure statement he signed with the publisher to coincide with the 60th anniversary of Roswell.
Yes.
In fact, I just got an email from him thanking me for the post the UFO updates.
Oh, good.
Yeah. I think he's supposed to keep his mouth shut about what's in the book. He's hinted a little bit, not much. He basically goes into his father's background and said there's no way his father could have not known a balloon for a balloon. But that's about all he said to me. He hasn't said anything more sensational than that. Anyway, so then we have the body site out near the Brazel Ranch, and perhaps a couple of witnesses to that. Oh, Lieutenant Colonel Marion Magruder's story.
Right.
Okay, now that's a biggie. And in fact, there was a post from Greg Boone saying, I know the Magruder family.
Greg Boone knows everybody.
Yeah, maybe there'll be more coming that direction. Anyway, Lieutenant Colonel Marion Magruder was sort of a legendary World War II Marine aviation commander, known as Black Mac Magruder. All his sons' names begin with M. Mike and Marion, and I forget the other two.
Mm-hmm.
There are five sons, and four of them talk to Carrie and Schmidt. They said on his deathbed, he said that he had seen the debris and been told about the crash and seen the live alien at Wright-Patterson. And the story was is that he was at the Air War College at Maxwell Field in Montgomery, Alabama. I've just been looking this up, and yeah, there was the new Air War College at Maxwell Field, and they were basically training the younger cream-of-the-crop officers to lead the future Army and Navy and Air Force. So far, I've been able to confirm that part of the story, that he was considered one of the elite officers, young officers after the war that were expected to lead the military.
Mm-hmm.
He was like the lowest-ranking officer there, being a lieutenant colonel, but they were lieutenant colonel on up. And they were flown to Wright Field, this was 2 weeks after the Roswell incident, and told they were brought up there to get their opinion on something very urgent. And they get there, and they're told that the spacecraft had crashed at Roswell. And this came as a shock to nearly all of them. Maybe one or two knew about it already. Then they pass the debris around, and nobody could identify it. Everybody talks about how strange this debris was and its properties. Then after that, they're led into a room, and they're shown the live alien that had survived. According to Mike Magruder, his father described what he called the creature as under 5 feet tall, kind of humanoid or human-like, but with longer arms, larger eyes, oversized, hairless head, slit for mouth, the usual description, two holes for a nose and ears, and no teeth was another one of his descriptions.
Mm.
And then the comment that there was no doubt in his mind that it came from another planet. So that was secondhand, unfortunately. It would have been great to get it from Lieutenant Colonel Magruder. But I guess if four members of the family said he told the story, then he probably did tell the story. There's a bunch of others from previous books. I think one of the more impressive accounts of aliens came from Captain Oliver Henderson, who was sort of a senior pilot at Roswell. And when the first stories about Roswell publicly came out in 1980, he started talking to his family about it and other people. And he said he had flown the crash wreckage of the flying saucer up to Wright-Patterson Field. And in addition, he'd seen three of the bodies. And again, it was large heads, the usual description. They were small with large heads. And he mentioned them packed in dry ice, which is interesting because Glenn Dennis also mentioned when he's asked about preservation techniques, suggesting that they packed the bodies in dry ice. There's a couple of other stories. This is the first time, though, I think I've seen firsthand accounts. Again, the biggie is Walter Hott, the public information officer, who sort of pled ignorance. Oh, I just put out the press release, and that's all I know. Finally, in 2000, he was interviewed by Dennis Balthaser and Wendy Connors. And he was doing an oral history, and it got around that he started to admit seeing the craft and the body in the hangar. Schmidt and Carey really have this nailed down with the affidavit that he filled out. By the way, I hope they don't mind, but I copied the affidavit, and it's now up on my website.
Oh, that'll be good to see.
So yeah. People can go there and read exactly what Hout had to say. The website is roswellproof.com, and roswellproof is all one word, and then /Hott, H-A-U-T, .html.
And I'll put that in the program listing.
Okay, great.
Or this
one.
And then, you know, people can just go there and click. Or if they remember what it is you said or just rewind for a moment, they'll hear it again.
And I have Hott's old affidavit from, I believe, 1994, where he says, I just put out the press release, and that's about all I know. That was his story. And Schmidt and Carey said the reason he didn't talk before this is because he made a promise to his friend, Colonel Blanchard, not to talk about it. I think there was more to it than that. My suspicion is he knew if he talked about seeing spacecraft and bodies that he would never hear the end of it while he was alive. I just don't think he wanted to get into that. I spoke to him in 2001, and he didn't really know who I was, and he didn't really want to talk to me.
Yes.
Don Schmidt asked him to talk to me when I was at the museum. He basically says, oh, I just don't remember anything after all these years. So he wouldn't tell me much.
How can you not remember that unless you unless you have Alzheimer's?
I can see the critics will say, well, he changed his story. He's a liar. I can see why somebody would lie about that or withhold information about it. I don't see somebody like Sheridan Cavett, the counterintelligence officer, who denied being at the base or in any way involved for years and years and years, and then he told the Air Force, oh, yeah, I was there, and all we found was a weather balloon crashed. Why would you withhold that information for years and years and claim you weren't even at the base if that's what you saw? He changed his story, but he gets no flack for that. And there was no reason for him to withhold that information. He wasn't telling anything worth withholding. Whereas I can see how it would withhold it for very good reasons.
I understand a lot of them withholding for fear of what would happen to their pensions or their families or... And just a whole bunch of reasons for not coming out. I don't want to scare the population. I don't want people to know that there are extraterrestrials out there.
Yeah. In fact, when I asked Hodd about procedures for press releases, I said, well, could you have released a press release about a flying disc being recovered without Blanchard's approval? And he says, no, absolutely not, you know.
Yeah.
I would write it up, and it would have to go back to him, and he would review it before I could put it out. And he says either he reviewed it or is Patrick Saunders.
The adjutant.
Yeah. So this guy would have known what was going on. In fact, I think Hodd mentions him as being at the morning meeting, you know, where they're discussing everything. And General Ramey is talking about it, that they're going to cover it up. Another thing interesting is that they even talked about telling the public everything. Then they didn't. So 60 years later, here we are in the same position of not being told everything.
I think it's very synchronistic, this book coming out and us sitting here discussing this now, when in the last program I talked with Don Burleson, also from Roswell, who has just published a book on UFOs and the death of Marilyn Monroe, in which... it's alleged that John F. Kennedy told Marilyn Monroe a number of state secrets, the most important of which was the fact that he had made a secret visit to an Air Force base and had seen the wreckage of a flying saucer and bodies when he was president.
I've heard that story, too, plus the fact that she was carrying on affairs with John Kennedy and Robert Kennedy.
Yes, yes.
I even remember the exact moment when I heard that she'd committed suicide. It was during the World Series. I was listening to it on the radio, and they broke in to announce, you know, that she'd died.
It's really hard to suicide with Nembutal, though, but...
it's really hard to suicide by tying a plastic bag around it.
Exactly, exactly.
There's also Dorothy Kilgallen.
The columnist who died under mysterious circumstances.
Supposedly an accidental overdose.
Yeah, but and so did her best friend.
Oh, that I didn't know.
Yes.
So the buzz about Dorothy Kilgallen is she'd written several columns during the 50s about UFOs and how it was hush-hush. And in 54, she talked about how there was going to be a... it was considered of such importance that the top military heads were going to meet... in the summer. And that was interesting because that seemed to coincide with one of these MJ-12 documents that was found in the National Archives about a meeting in the summer of 1954. So whether she got that right or not, or whether the two were related, I don't know. But anyway, she wrote a couple columns on rumored flying saucer crashes, and she had her sources. Of course, the story I hear about Kilgallen is... she had spoken to Jack Ruby, and she supposedly had the inside story on the Kennedy assassination and was going to reveal it, and then she turned up dead.
One of the things that Don Burleson pointed out in our interview was that not only was the FBI and the CIA involved in tapping both of Marilyn's phones, but so were the Mafia, because the Mafia knew that Bobby Kennedy was also having an affair with Marilyn Monroe.
Yeah, there's nothing like blackmail to keep people quiet.
Well, yeah, and the Mafia were being seriously investigated by the Department of Justice, headed by Bobby Kennedy.
You know, one of the theories scenarios of a Kennedy assassination was that the mafia was in on it. And there's more coming out on the Kennedy assassination now, and I even have sort of a personal connection to it, as I found out recently.
Oh, really?
Yeah. But maybe that's for another...
For another program.
Another program. One conspiracy at a time is all I can handle.
Well, the reason that you're so involved, or one of the reasons that you're so involved in this whole Roswell scenario, is you were part of the team that was working on deciphering the Ramey memorandum that he was holding in his hand when the photographs were taken of the weather balloon debris in the office at Roswell.
Right, and according to Marcel and Colonel DuBose, who was, according to Hott, was at that meeting in Roswell that morning, is the weather balloon was just the cover story to get rid of the press, because even the press in Roswell was in on the fact that there was something going on. So they were being harassed, and DuBose said he personally took the call from Washington to start the cover-up. So Marcel said that when he went to Fort Worth to see General Ramey and show them some of the debris, that Ramey took him to the map room and said, you know, show me where all this is going on. And when he came back, they'd substituted a weather balloon. And that's also in Hott's affidavit. He said Marcel told him that when he came back from Fort Worth. Ramey brought in an old weather balloon on the floor and a torn-up radar target made out of foil paper and balsa wood. It's basically just a balsa wood kite, designed so that it would very effectively reflect radar back towards the radar transmitter, and you could track the balloons
and know what the wind speed was.
You could tell what the winds were at higher altitudes. So the skeptics say, well, that's all Marcel found. It was this exotic debris he'd never seen. He misidentified it, and Colonel Blanchard went along with it, and Hott put out the press release. They were all a bunch of idiots at Roswell. Anyway, while these pictures are being taken, and one of the pictures, Ramey, actually there are four pictures of Ramey that we know of. He's holding this slip of paper in his hand. In three of the pictures, the paper has the back to the camera. In one, he's angled the paper up as if he was trying to take a look at it, and the camera gets an angle on this piece of paper. And you can see the printing on there. And this is what we call the Ramey memo. And there had been attempts to look at it dating back to 1985. Brad Sparks, I think, claims he was the first to take a look at it. And back then he was picking out the words disc on it and weather balloons in Fort Worth, Texas.
Mm-hmm.
The photographer James Bond Johnson, I believe in 99, wanted to take another look at it. So he got some blow-ups and he got a team together. And one of the words they picked out there was victims. So that got my interest and other people's interest, and I took a look at it, and I agree. And I think most people agree who look at this, that there's the phrase, the victims of the wreck in there. And so if there were victims, that's corroboration that there were bodies that were recovered.
Yes.
And the fact that the words weather balloons there indicates this is definitely about Roswell. I also independently of Sparks picked out the word disc. Everybody now greets the word disc is there, and I believe the phrase is, in the disc they will ship. So a radar target doesn't have any insides. It's just a balsa wood framework, and they string this foil paper over it. It's like saying a sheet of paper has an inside to it.
Yes.
So he's not going to be talking about something inside the radar target. And he's calling it a disc. He doesn't call it a radar target. He calls it a disc. So they're the words disc and victims, and it's obviously about the crash object being a disc, and there being victims involved.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's a smoking gun. It's a piece of documentation. It's not like the MJ-12 papers. We don't know where they came from. General Ramey's holding it in his hand. He's standing over the weather balloon, and he's got the smoking gun in his hand. It's telling a different story than the weather balloon story. It goes right along with the other testimony about there being a real spacecraft and the bodies. We have the first-hand witnesses to the bodies and a bunch of second-hand witnesses.
After these years where researchers have said, well, you know, we're not going to find any more evidence, and here's a book with just a whole bunch more that adds to the picture and certainly points to something more than a weather balloon going down north of Roswell. And when you start and put all of these pieces of evidence together, including the Ramey memo and Marilyn Monroe's murder, and for why the only state secret left that hasn't been disclosed is Jack Kennedy's viewing of wreckage and bodies from a UFO, a flying saucer crash in New Mexico. What other flying saucer crash was there that would have produced bodies and wreckage?
Yeah, and we have General Exxon up at Wright-Patterson talking about this being a spacecraft and the bodies being recovered and the strange material they analyzed there at Wright-Patterson. He flew over the crash sites afterwards and confirmed the tire tracks on the ground and the gashes in the countryside. And then there's Barry Goldwater, presidential nominee and very powerful senator in the Republican Party. He became chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee and Armed Services Committee one time. And his story was he knew Colonel Blanchard, then General Blanchard. He became a four-star general. He was good friends with Curtis LeMay, who was also involved in this back in 1947. LeMay was briefing General Vandenberg at the Pentagon, who was acting chief of staff at that time. He was briefing him on the flying saucer situation. And an interesting thing is on July 8, 1947, I'm rambling here a little bit, there was a suddenly called meeting of the Joint Research and Development Board that Vandenberg went to. It lasted 2.5 hours. LeMay briefed him beforehand. And this is another part of UFO history. What was the Joint Research and Development Board? Well, that was run by Dr. Vannevar Bush, who had headed scientific military research during World War II. He was one of the most important people in the country back then during World War II. And after the war, he wanted continued scientific military research. He, with the Defense Department, set up the Joint Research and Development Board. Right after Roswell, the National Security Act passed, which set up the CIA and the Research and Development Board. And he became head of that. And this, what's significant is that in 1950, a Canadian radio engineer by the name of Wilbert Smith received a briefing when he was in Washington that was arranged by the Canadian embassy that Dr. Vannevar Bush was heading up a highly secret UFO study group within the Research and Development Board. And we think, some of us think anyway, that this is what is called MJ-12 or Majestic 12, because he was supposed to be a member of that, and that was supposed to be the oversight committee that was set up in 1947 by President Truman. So anyway, getting back to the morning of July 8, 1947, this is simultaneous with the morning meeting in Roswell, where they're talking about covering the thing up.
Right.
Back at the Pentagon, there was another meeting that Vandenberg was on his schedule. It's canceled, and instead he meets with the Joint Research and Development Board, headed by Vannevar Bush. And he's briefed by Curtis LeMay, you know, right before it. So I don't think this is a coincidence. And there were other things in Vandenberg's schedule that hint at other things going on. And Barry Goldwater said he knew Blanchard, he knew LeMay. He himself was a general in the Air Force Reserve. He flew jets. He heard about, probably from Blanchard, about the artifacts, the alien artifacts at Wright-Patterson. And he wanted to see them. He tried cooperating with Donald Kehoe to get congressional investigations going in the early 60s. So he had a long-standing interest in the subject. His story that Goldwater told many times is that when he brought this up with LeMay, who was Air Force Chief of Staff, I think, at the time, LeMay, this good friend of his, you know, just took his head off, just swore at him and said, you don't ever bring this up again. Even I'm not allowed to go in there. So we have that from Barry Goldwater. Don't know why he would make that up. There was Stephen Lovkin, who was the Disclosure Project, one of their witnesses. He said he was in the Signal Corps in the White House. He was just a sergeant back then, And this was 59 to 61, so it was right at the end of the Eisenhower administration, beginning of the Kennedy administration. He said he would see Pentagon briefings. They were shown debris from a 1947 New Mexico crash. Well, that had to be Roswell, of course. He didn't say Roswell. And this included one of the I-beams, you know, with symbols on it. They were told about bodies, too, and he said there were either three or five. He says it was a little unclear. So we get these other stories. There's a whole bunch of them. None of them in themselves is conclusive. But, you know, you start getting back to Roswell, and we now have some firsthand witnesses from that time period, people who were at the base saying, yeah, I saw the bodies, either out in the field or at the base.
Hmm.
Like I said at the beginning, I think it's reaching a critical mass where you just can't ignore this anymore. Not if you're semi-fair, I think, at even looking at the evidence.
It'll be interesting to hear what Stan Friedman and Kevin Randall make of all of this.
I know Kevin Randall has no love of Don Schmidt. Whether he'll use that to attack this book or not, I don't know. So I can't say I know the credibility of each of these witnesses.
Yeah.
I just think there's so many of them at this point that they can't all be,
exactly,
be lying. And the other thing that impresses me is they're telling these very, very, very consistent accounts. The details seem very similar, and the stories just fit together so well. And unless there's another vast conspiracy of witnesses getting together and getting their stories straight, I just don't see how this can be happening by chance. I think they filled in a lot of gaps. The second site, the craft body site, being discovered on July 7th makes a lot of sense to me in many ways. I still haven't thought through all the ramifications of this new scenario, but that does make a lot of sense. The fact that one of the earliest scenarios in the early Randall Schmidt books that came from Frank Kaufman primarily is that the crash took place on the night of July 4th, and they were out at the site on July 5th. And one of the things that always bothered me about that scenario was if they already knew about the crash on July 5th, why were they relatively cavalier about Brazel when he came to town and reported the wreckage? It seems like Jesse Marcel would have known about it, for example. Had they already known about this craft and body site, when this rancher came to town and reported this unusual debris, I think they would have immediately pounced on it and immediately begun a recovery effort out there. I don't think they would have sent two people out and waited 2 days before they began a recovery effort. So the fact that they had already gone out to investigate this debris field and then this other craft was discovered with the bodies makes a lot more sense to me, you know, as a sequence of events. And the other thing was the second body site also makes sense to me. It would explain Frank Joyce's story that went back quite a ways, and testimony isn't quite as consistent or detailed as, say, the debris field or the main craft site, but I think there is something to it. I can see where bodies might have come down somewhere else, maybe been discovered by Brazel after he discovered all the debris on his ranch.
Yes.
And the other thing they talk about, I didn't even put in my post, there's a lot more witnesses in this. The ranchers in the area knew about this before the military got involved. Brazel had been talking it up, and debris had been passed around, and ranchers and their kids had been going out to the ranch and picking up debris and taking it home. And then afterwards, the military went around, and they just terrorized the ranches in the area and tore them apart, looking for any debris that they might have hidden away. Unfortunately, they don't name names and document this very well. They mentioned one account from a rancher saying that another rancher at one point showed him a piece of this memory foil, threw it up in the air, and was shooting at it with a rifle, and the bullets would ricochet off. So that was one of the accounts. Glenn Dennis, when I spoke to him, he said, I know all the ranchers in the area. You know, when they have a funeral, I would take care of them. The ranchers know a lot more about what happened out there. He says, but they're not going to talk. He sort of hinted that there was a lot more information out there among people who lived around the Foster Ranch And maybe Schmidt and Carey have finally gotten some of the people to talk. I don't know.
Perhaps once this book circulates and the word of it circulates, it will bring not so much witnesses, but descendants of witnesses.
Yeah, of course, we always want the first-hand stories.
Well, 60 years
when you hear 100 second-hand stories saying the same thing, it's hard to ignore. You know? I think there were 5 or 6 first-hand accounts of bodies, the Schmidt-Carey book, and there must be at least several dozen second-hand witnesses, mostly the family members. So it's getting to be a very, very large body of witnesses about bodies. I, for one, cannot ignore it. It's just getting to be too many people. There's a very clear narrative that's coming out of all these witnesses, but it was sort of scattered around in the book. It wasn't real clear. It would have been nice if they had a chapter just putting it all together like that.
Probably the rush to get it out in time for the 60th anniversary.
I remember when the Corso book came out 10 years ago, that was another theory as to why it was so badly written, that there was a big rush to get it out there for the 50th anniversary.
Yes.
I still think there may be something to Corso. I don't totally write the man off like a lot of people do.
I met him at the 50th down there in Roswell. Very sweet old man, very genuine, appeared to be fully aware of what was going on around him and what the book contained.
I was in Seattle at the time the book came out. It was right in time for Kenneth Arnold's 50th anniversary, his sighting up there on June 24. And that's when the Corso book came out, and I rushed out and I got it at the bookstore. I said, oh, finally, the scoop on Roswell, and I opened it up, and I was horrifically disappointed, you know, when
yes,
I read it.
Yes.
Because there was obviously a bunch of nonsense and a lot of factual inaccuracy in the book. I can't argue with the skeptics who make all those points. I mean, that's all true. There's something in my gut that says he did know something about Roswell and the crash recovery and what happened afterwards, even if it wasn't well-written, ghost-written, you know, by William Burns.
Bill Burns at UFO Magazine now, yes. I hate to call a stop to this because
we could go on. Go on a long time,
But let's see how things proceed in the next weeks, and perhaps we can talk again.
Yeah, I would like to see comments from other people.
Yes, me too. With any luck, some of the principals.
Yeah, that would be real lucky. It would be nice to get some of these witnesses on the show, wouldn't it?
Wouldn't it, though?
If they're still around.
Yes.
I don't know if any of them are around. I guess a couple of them are still around.
Okay, David Rudiak, thank you, sir.
And thank you again for having me on the show.
It's always a pleasure. I look forward to talking to you again and seeing your posts almost every day on the list. It's good.
Okay, thank you, Errol.
Thanks, David.
Yeah, bye-bye.
Bye. Every couple of weeks, we head down to Alabama. That's where regular biweekly contributor Alfred Lemberg lives. And after the two-part David Rudiak program, Alfred Lemberg joins us on Strange Days Indeed. Good day, Alfred. Oh, you're getting so much better with that.
Yes, I'm becoming very accomplished.
Yes, you are. One of the few people I know who has become a virtuoso on the Alabama fog whistle.
While stomping on California barking spiders.
Strange days.
Indeed.
Yes, yes.
Well, in the first place, let me say kudos to Dave Rudiak for his elegant, if not eloquent, reporting and a conclusive reporting on what seems to be an important new book that has several people jumping up and down, not the least of which is Dave Rudiak, but also William Burns seems to be doing his own share of jumping up and down in regard to that book. Well, it sounds like a very impressive and a very interesting book, trying to forget the apparent fishiness of it coming at the 60th anniversary of Roswell. But Tom Carey and Don Schmidt seem to have produced something substantive. Witness to Roswell. And it seems like it's going to be a pretty interesting book.
I don't know that a lot of people, and I know you're connected with UFO Magazine, but just to be contentious, I know a lot of people are not totally thrilled with Bill Burns. And
I'll be thrilled enough for everyone.
Just because management at UFO Magazine listens to this program.
Oh, do they? Do you think they do?
I know they do.
Oh, really?
They're subscribed.
Well, I better clean up my act then and get even more obsequious. At any rate, my understanding is he's pretty interested in the book from the standpoint of... here it is again, and Stewart noticed it himself. Roswell just does not stop. It doesn't go away. It doesn't run down. It doesn't run out of steam. It just keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And now we have this new book by Carey and Schmidt indicating that there are all sorts of new witnesses abounding.
Why do you think it is that Roswell doesn't run down, doesn't run out of steam, as you quote?
Well, I think
Miller.
On account of it's the truth. I think it really happened. I think there was some kind of craft of, call it extra-dimensional, call it extra-temporal, call it extraterrestrial, call it whatever you want. But something piloted by an other had its little difficulty there in the vicinity of Roswell, New Mexico, and I think all that went down. I think there's too much evidence across 6 categories indicating that that is so. So I'm not going to waste a whole lot of time wondering if it happened or not. I think it really did.
So you're happy with the saucer head appellation that will be laid on you?
Oh, absolutely. I welcome it. I treasure it.
Yes.
But seriously, if you've got people of the caliber of David Rudiak and Kevin Randall, there's Stanton Friedman, there's myself, there's yourself. You know, there's all sorts of people out there, I think, even more credible than yourself and myself, that think something definitely shook down out there. And lately, Carey and Schmidt seem to do the same thing. Talking about that book, and I think it's wonderful, the spear point that David Rudiak has given this thing in that very elegant and conclusive report that he gave on it. I think the theme of that book, David pointed it out real well, is that the theme of the book is that new witnesses do abound, all right? And it's witnesses we didn't have before, and when you consider it, let's say every one of those witnesses are lying, misstating, mentally ill, or especially mendacious, but just one of them, Errol, just one of them has to be given the straight scoop, and it's a whole new ballgame. And I think that's the issue.
Yep.
They can't all be lying and mentally ill and mendacious. You know, no. I mean, if just one, and I think there's probably more than one.
It's interesting the way that there is a coalescing of information in one form or another about Roswell that is coming out in view of what we've discussed in the last, two or three programs.
Oh, I think so, too, and I think that the Internet is going a long way towards making that happen and providing a venue for that information that, you just didn't have even 10 years ago, you know.
Mm-hmm. And it'll be interesting to see if the confessions of the CIA, which are about to be released, will include anything about Roswell. I have my doubts, but it'll be interesting to see.
I'll bet you it does. Many of the things that David Rudiak was talking about, very interesting stuff that he may have discovered on his own just reading between the lines. When he reported that initial subterfuge by reporting the debris field at Roswell to keep people away from that second crash site that apparently is just littered with little alien bodies.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I thought that was very interesting. The subterfuge from the very start.
Mm-hmm.
Crazy stuff. I'm also interested in the amount of, numerous military policemen at the time and shortly after the time as first and second-hand witnesses. I think that's very significant.
Very. And as always, whenever there is any sort of military incident, you always get military police there.
Yep.
So I guess if one had to label the various witnesses in terms of trustworthiness, military police would be high on the list.
Well, at least until the boys from CSI get hold of it and come up with some trumped-up study saying military policemen and cops in general are the biggest liars in the universe.
You mean the former PSYCOP, the so-called Committee for Investigation into the Claims of the Paranormal, who now call themselves CSI?
Oh, yeah, I think those guys have just pretty much relegated themselves to complete invalidity by this point, and I think that's reflected by their name change, trying to garner a little favor with popular programs on television. I think we've pretty much beat them down between you and me, Errol. I think
we did an amazingly good job, you and I.
Oh, yes. I think civilization owes us a definite debt of gratitude. But more interesting stuff from Dave Rudiak. Apparently there's many more people remembering that memory foil than anybody knew about before. It was just a couple before, but now apparently they're falling out of the woodwork, people that crumpled up the little piece of tin foil that magically returned to its previous state.
And I have to bet that somebody somewhere has a little piece of that foil picked up as a souvenir by one of the searchers for the foil at the crash site.
Well, wasn't that crash site, the debris field, like hundreds of meters long and tens of meters wide? And I'd be astonished if somebody didn't poke something a little bit weird in their pocket just for a keepsake, you know?
Yeah. And it's sitting in somebody's attic or in somebody's treasure box.
Forgotten.
Yeah.
It'll turn up, well, tomorrow, day after tomorrow.
Okay.
Interesting stuff that Rudiak reported with regard to the apparent profundity now of live alien stories that I wasn't hearing before, which is really what all this is kind of about, actually, don't you think?
Well, there was the rumor, or there were reports, that there was one survivor who supposedly lived on for quite a while after.
Mm-hmm.
And what we're getting now is confirmation of those rumors.
Suggested confirmation.
Evidence from other witnesses to that surviving being.
Truth that is held self-evident? No. You know, one thing I thought was kind of interesting, too, you know, when we were talking earlier about it being kind of fishy, that this book comes up around the 60th anniversary of Roswell. And I indicated that I really thought that it was the truth and something really had occurred over there, given Randall and Friedman and actually dozens of other quality researchers that think something really must have occurred over there, given the lost message traffic and the reports of lockdowns on the base that had never occurred before or since, you know, and just crazy things that were going on.
Yeah.
But I got to thinking, okay, the obvious and self-evident truth that is plain to me individually and personally, I got to thinking that, you know, maybe that because there are so many witnesses and so many people that realize the truth of that thing, whatever it was that occurred at Roswell in 1947, that it made it easier for the whole town to kind of embrace that alien concept, turning the whole town over into what is, well, what could probably be called a theme park in the regard of extraterrestrial visitation and what have you. That it's truth that made it do that, not the myth. You know what I'm saying?
Yes. Of course, among that whole clump of Roswell-related information that's appearing now, coincident with the 60th anniversary of the crash, is Jesse Marcel Jr.'s book, too. So
Right. Add
that to the pot.
You're kind of off the subject here a little bit, but I'm doing a series of things now on the memory of Jesse Marcel Sr. and what happened to his reputation with regard to the pieces done, the research completed by Robert Todd on Jesse Marcel, and just kind of besmirching his whole memory. And I got a poem on my blog this week and then an upcoming article for UFO Magazine that explores that. I hope gives a little honor back where it should go, which I think is to Jesse Marcel.
Good for you. I look forward to reading that.
Some of the things that Rudiak was reporting with regard to seems like dozens, at least multiple, reluctant witnesses who are dying in mysterious circumstances, like suicide by wrapping a plastic bag around your head.
Yeah.
I thought that was kind of peculiar. And then he also brings up again something I've been hearing for years, but apparently it's even more expansive, is that red-headed captain running around threatening everybody's life if they talk about it,
mm-hmm.
and all of this is happening in different accounts by disparate people that don't know of each other and haven't talked to each other, and I don't know that they have or haven't, but again, man, just one clear report, and it's a whole new ballgame.
What also was interesting was the statement about the ranchers in the area, who were a very close community, and many of them apparently were out at the crash site and at the debris site.
Right, the Proctors.
But unlike the Proctors, none of those families have come forward and said, hey, I was there and this is what I saw.
Well, there is that report of, I don't know whether it was a male Proctor or a female Proctor, but was out with Brazel to look at the debris field and was completely traumatized and never wanted to speak of it again.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was weird, crazy stuff.
Yes.
But with regard to Glenn Dennis, talking about the redheaded captain, just come up in other places, the fellow that was right there getting the call, you know, the very pertinent questions about child caskets and mortuary techniques, and that there is someone else that knew the famous mystery nurse that Glenn Dennis was discredited on?
That's an interesting, actually, because, yes, somebody else did know the nurse, and Glenn Dennis had just thrown out a name, presumably in order to protect her identity. And then there was the secretary who supposedly committed suicide, as you mentioned earlier, putting a plastic bag over her head and securing it around her neck. What a really odd way to suicide.
I would think pretty damn near impossible, actually.
Seems to me. Survival instinct would kick in, and as you gasped for breath.
And the fact that Skeptibunkies and ardent class Curtsians are blown out of the water with their stipulation that there was only four nurses on that entire base in that wing.
Yeah.
There's every conceivability that there could have been tens of tens. Just incredible stuff.
She could have been a civilian nurse and not a military nurse. Presumably the military nurses there with the senior nursing staff,
mm-hmm.
and however many civilian nurses on the base. So the nurse who freaked out and Glenn Dennis was trying to protect could well be one of those civilian nurses.
And when you think in terms of why would those nurses have to be protected, you have to think in terms of these nurses' cards that are strangely reclassified again after all of this time.
Mm-hmm.
Peculiar stuff.
Very strange.
Indeed. That testimony during the period about the lockdown and the strange rumors of recovery ops that people were talking about after all of these years.
Yes.
That's more crazy stuff put along with all the lost message traffic, and you have these reports and then the reports of the bodies and the reports over a period of time, and it's actually being announced by the government, and you were always wondering, now why did they do that? Why did they announce something like that? Seems like they would have wanted to kept that close to their vest, except when you discover that they announced that to keep everybody from looking for the other thing that was even more crazy and telling and unsettling.
Boy, the evidence sure is mounting up, isn't it?
It does indeed.
Strange days.
Oh, yeah, geez. The expansive witness testimony that comes up as a result of this book, we're looking at dozens of new witnesses, and I think it's going to breathe new life into Roswell, much to the horror and chagrin of some, I'm sure, and aggregate ufology as well, in the bargain. I'm looking forward to more interest and more attention, more consciousness raising in this regard.
I'm sort of on the fence about that. I'm not sure what it's going to do, if anything.
Likely, if history is any guide, it's not going to do anything at all, but... Man, I've got some high hopes. I mean, you can only strike the tinder so many times before even the damp catches fire and we start cooking away with it.
Mm.
Great collection of smelly alien stories. I don't think I've heard so many in one spot that just, I mean, really turned my stomach and made my flesh crawl the way these did. You know,
yes.
Jeez, man, I had to go in and shower. You know,
mm.
But great collection of smelly alien stories. The discussion with Sheridan Cavett and Marcel being pretty much the number one and two intelligence guys on the entire base for a very high-dollar, high-visibility program, like being the only outfit that could deliver a nuclear device to a target and make it explode, these are just not the two guys that you're going to send out to look at a weather balloon, you know?
Yes.
Or a mogul balloon, or any kind of
or balloon. A crash test dummy from the future.
Yeah, really. With regard to Marion Magruder, Magruder was the guy that flew the debris to Wright-Patterson. I'm glad that's kind of coming up, and they're kind of fleshing out Magruder a little bit. I think that's an essential component of the story, how stuff is being moved around the United States, covered tarpaulins and on trucks and air travel. I think it's significant to kind of give all of that background, kind of fleshes out the story a little bit more.
And the question is, why would there be all of that traffic, especially air traffic? Why would an aircraft be put over a bomb pit and something loaded into it if nothing had come down out there in the high desert?
It just gets curious and curious
does,
as
though.
Time goes on.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Again, as Stuart pointed out, I think this is one of the reasons why this story just does not go away. It only gets more expansive and full-featured and detailed over the years.
Yes.
I was really glad that David Rudiak got to talk a little bit about his Ramey memo. See, a lot of the skeptobunkies are looking at that and saying, oh, come on. David Rudiak is pulling that out of the air because it's just wishful thinking that he's determining what those words could have meant. But no, that's not the case. When you look at the document and you run the potentialities through a computer, there are only a few words that remotely fit. So his analysis of the Ramey memo there is key in indicating just exactly what he said it indicated, is that there was a crash and that bodies were involved. I mean, case closed in the vernacular.
And not only was it David Rudiak who worked on the memo, but it was people like Don Burleson down there in Roswell and other image analysts who spent a lot of time looking at that photograph. Those of you who don't know what we're talking about, and you should if you were listening carefully, was that General Ramey had a piece of paper in his hand that James Bond Johnson photograph of Ramey and Marcel and the weather balloon debris.
It's very key stuff when the fellow is holding a document in his hand, belying, in fact, what you're actually seeing in the photograph around you. And did you ever wonder, Errol, why he would even bring that document in and hold it in his hand unless he was showing it to people?
It's actually a teletype message. Either a copy of a message from him up the line of command or from further up the line of command down to him. We're not sure which, but it was definitely a communications message rather than something that was typed for him on a typewriter somewhere.
But very weird to have it in your hand like that unless you're purposefully showing it to people, saying, hey, pay no attention to the man behind the curtain and all this crap on the floor. Here's the real deal, you know.
Interesting, but we don't know the circumstances under which that picture was taken and what was going on at that precise moment. Maybe he'd just been handed that as the photo session was being set up.
Yeah. And I was glad, too, that Wilbert Smith got a positive mention. That guy's taken a lot of heat lately for being a wacko and a wukookian, and I don't think that's the case very much at all. I think there's a lot more to the heroism of Wilbert Smith along with the heroism of Jesse Marcel that is kind of unsung at this point, and I'm hopeful that someday that they will be properly sung.
Interesting things going on behind the scenes here in Canada. There's a researcher who has used some of Wilbert Brockhaus Smith's papers to create a lifting force field that will move an object back and forth and creates a plasma field around the object.
Well, that's pretty astonishing.
And this is based on what Smith contends the boys, as he called them, the boys' topside had given him. And there's a certain amount of concern on the part of this researcher for his safety in view of what he has created from those notes of Smith's.
Well, let's keep our attention on him, and maybe we can give him a bye. Finishing up with Dave Rudiak here, the last thing that you guys talked about was the speculation or wondering based on Kevin Randall's enmity that he might have with Don Schmidt, and only suggested by David Rudiak, that Randall would use personal considerations, perhaps, to attack the book on that level. I really don't think that that would happen. I think that Randall would give it a fair shot if it deserved it for a fair shot, and that any criticism that he's going to have will be a fair criticism and worth listening to.
I think when we finish talking here, I'm going to wander over to Kevin Randall's blog and see what he has to say about it, if anything.
I've been over there recently, I think yesterday, and there wasn't anything there yet. So, yeah, it's worth keeping up on. I'm sure he'll write something about it.
He was doing things military after the last time we talked. He's actually been remarkably quiet, as has Stan Friedman.
Friedman's pretty busy, though. He's hither and yon and doing what he usually does and does best.
Yeah, and he doesn't do a lot of communication on the road.
No.
At least not with the UFO updates list.
No. So, on to Stuart Miller. What a killer program it was this time. You know, a couple of interesting things coming up. I appreciate Stuart Miller turning the corner and deciding that perhaps he needs to become a skeptic. yes, I'm looking forward to that. There was speculation, and this is where that thing that we'd alluded to earlier, why isn't there any commentary on the Rudiak commentary or on this book yet?
Still not, as of this recording.
And I got to thinking about it while I was listening. It's actually the same kind of thing, like we have a lack of commentary on that Newman fiction that he wrote right after Roswell.
Mm-hmm.
Bernard Newman, and that book that he wrote that really kind of trotted out all the details of Roswell just right after the fact, and they're really kind of significant for other reasons that we'll talk to here in a minute when we get to the point where Miller was actually talking about Rudiak's commentary. But the point being that there is no commentary because, see, once you start looking at this stuff, you get to the point where you start having to look a little bit too hard and you get scared at the new shadows that are perceived. Things are opening up and speeding up and accelerating to the point where people are reluctant to want to address it or get into it because it is so frightening and because that it's a slippery slope. One step and boom, you're on the ride. You can't even get started with this stuff before the whole balloon explodes.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's why you don't hear commentary about things that should be commented on.
I think you're right.
When you think about it, you've got a real potential pustule here. If you pop that puppy, it's going to be a lot of cleanup. There's no talking about it. There's no talking mean about it. But one of the things that Stuart Miller brought up was the fact that there were no skeptics on the list anymore. And the UFO updates was losing credibility because there was not a recognized skeptical voice on there. And he wondered where all the skeptics had gone.
Yeah, they've disappeared along with the people that are quitting ufology. I think the skeptics have just pretty much given up. The honest skeptics are still around and walk among us yet and key among us yet and talk among us yet. But the debunkers either become bored with it or realize that it's not going to make places like UFO updates go away and the people on it.
Well, and maybe too, Errol, they couldn't sell their shtick and they were driven off for cause. And UFO updates was famous for it's getting right up in your face when it was thought to be necessary with some of these skeptical voices that were not being balanced, were not taking the long view, were not really interested in doing anything but to shill their lackluster little paradigm. For my money. So I think they were driven off for cause because they realized they couldn't get any traction amidst a group of genuine, free-thinking, open-minded people. Stuart alluded to the fact that people are really not wanting to talk about the tough stuff, the twitchy stuff, stuff that's difficult to talk about, that's difficult to admit. This whole field is like that. But I'm asked personally very little about the stuff that I'm writing about or talking about. I don't get questions or challenges on it. And I think what I'm talking about generally is a real banality of evil that, like wolves hiding in sheep's clothing in the form of skeptobunkies and class curtsians and what have you. They're masquerading as some kind of elite scientific reductionism or erstwhile science. These fellows that we're talking about that don't seem to be wanting to challenge me for what the hell I'm talking about. There's some discussion maybe on perhaps that I'm unable to be understood, perhaps. My point being, we don't want to talk about the tough stuff, and I think that the reality is that we do want to talk about the tough stuff, and people do not, for the reasons that we were talking about earlier with the Rudiak commentary. Why no commentary on things that need commentary? Well, because they're scary and because they're unsettling, and they indicate that maybe you don't know what you thought you knew, or maybe that everything that you knew is wrong. I embrace that. I want to find that out if it's true, and it would seem to me that everybody should.
It's the nature of the beast. There's this morbid fascination with things, and yet at the same time, one doesn't want to prod it too hard in case it strikes back or strikes out.
I understand that, and I appreciate it. And the point is we cannot live our life that way in the first place. And in the second place, we never really have and been successful. We are human beings. We strive forward. We move forward. We challenge. We occupy. We make it happen. Talking more about Stuart Miller and some of the things that he brought up, he indicated that if we got rid of the top stuff with regard to ufology, if we got rid of Roswell, if we got rid of Aztec, if we got rid of even, as was pointed out, the very effective top 10 ufological occurrences of all time from best evidence from Paul Kimball just lately, if we got rid of every one of those cases, we'd still have an awful lot of quality stuff to examine.
Precisely. And that's what the civilian population doesn't seem to get. It's not just Roswell. And the civilian population really has no idea about any of the others. It's always been Roswell, Roswell, Roswell. And now, finally, there is more evidence to suggest that something definitely happened in the desert.
Again, for about the sixth time.
Yes.
Stuart Miller bringing up that new credo that we apparently have going on, speculating that one is insane by way of whether or not they have a UFO interest.
Mm-hmm.
And I agree with you 100% that it's a cheap shot, it's a valueless shot, it's an irresponsible shot, and it's an irrelevant shot.
Yeah, it has nothing to do with the price of bacon.
Nothing to do. With regard to Bernard Newman and what we were talking about earlier and him writing this book just on the heels of Roswell, about all the neat stuff that happened in Roswell with alien autopsy films and beams and memory foils and all of these things that became part of the legend later on. I was really confused with the attitude that you and Stuart seemed to have. My thinking is Newman's fiction being written right on the heels of what actually occurred, apparently, at Roswell, kind of lends credence to Roswell, and that's the smoking gun. Something actually occurred, and here we have intelligence who is writing a fiction about this thing, in effect trying to cover it up, maybe, trying to make it go away.
I don't know.
Well, that's the point. We don't know. But this Bernard Newman needs to be looked at, investigated. I think we got a finger on a little trigger here.
And you Brits who are listening to this need to look into Bernard Newman or Bernard Newman more deeply.
And Errol, I think I can finish up on this. It's towards the end of Stuart's segment, and he was asking you more or less to the effect a question that said as much. You don't really believe in aliens, do you? Do you recall that? You know what I'm talking about? He did say, no, you don't really believe in aliens.
Well, let me respond.
And you said, that's the point. You said, well, I don't know if it's extra-dimensional or extra-temporal or extraterrestrial or intraterrestrial, but, man, I've had some weird experiences of my own, and yeah, I've got every sneaking suspicion that something's going on out there, given the fact that they've had to dress up the Drake equation here just recently with millions upon millions of new planets, which demonstrably changes the whole landscape of that formula and indicating many more intelligences than were thought before. The six categories of evidence that I'm always going on about indicating something ufological going on in what amounts to an infinite amount of space and time and surface area. And I was just very pleased for you to report that, yes, I do indeed. I really do believe in this alien.
You have to remember that I'm not a believer. I'm a knower. There is a difference. I have seen things. I have had experiences. In the same way that I don't believe in God because I haven't had experience of God. Ooh.
That offends my sense of rooster worship, but other than that, good stuff. stuff, and I really enjoyed the program. Wonderful, wonderful stuff. I'm hoping we can do this for decades upon decades and ending.
Oh, no, please, let's get an answer soon. I want to get a life. I'm about ready to retire, and I'd like to do something else with my remaining active years.
Okay, we'll look around for something for you.
Thank you. As long as it doesn't entail email lists and podcasts. It's been dragging on far too long for my taste. Since I got re-involved again, I'd like a solution really soon, please.
Likely we won't have one.
Well, if I die before I find out, as I've said a few times on this program, I'm going to come back as a really pissed ghost, and being where it is that I am after I pass, I will know who has had that information, and are they going to hear from me?
And I'm going to spend some time haunting Andy Robert's water closet, too.
Oh, what an ugly image to end up with.
How tragically complete.
Ooh.
Okay, all right. Yep, I've gone too far, and I've had enough.
That sounds like a wrap-up to me, Alfred Lemberg.
I've got nothing further, sir.
I'm sure you will have in a week or two, so we will revisit you down there in Alabama. Thank you, Alfred, as always.
Auf Wiedersehen, mein Herr.
Auf Wiedersehen, Alfred Lemberg. Bye. And that's it for this podcast. Glad you could be along. My thanks to all of you. My thanks to Dave Ferlot, David Rudiak, and Alfred Lemberg. Always good to hear from you, sdi@virtuallystrange.net. Coming up in the next podcast, since abductions are being discussed on the UFO updates list, and there has not been a lot of featuring of abductions in the media of late, we'll catch up with Dr. David Jacobs and see what he's been up to since we last spoke to him a couple of years ago.
That's this edition of Strange Days Indeed, hosted and produced by Errol Bruce Knapp. The executive producer is Gene Mascardelli. Send any questions or comments to sdi@virtuallystrange.net. Strange Days Indeed is the copyright of Random Fit Productions. Join us again next Saturday for more Strange Days Indeed from the Virtually Strange Network.